I think communicating with each pitcher in terms of what his vision for his personal process is, and then communicating, you know, your vision, and then kind of meshing the two together, I think is important, because the player needs to have ownership and belief in what he's doing. I think that's really important.
What's up and welcome to Ahead of the Curve. I am Jonathan Gellner, and thank you so much for being here. This episode is brought to you by Baseball Cloud. Baseball Cloud's revolutionary software platform brings to life the numbers captured by TrackMan and FlightScope. This provides colleges, players, and facility owners around the world a turnkey product, allowing them to analyze their data using key metrics and custom visualizations on one intuitive user interface. Go to baseballcloud.com to find out how you can have your own data analytics department for your program. Data has a story to tell, and Baseball Cloud gives it a voice. On today's show, we welcome the pitching coach for the University of North Carolina, Robert Woodard. Robert returned to his alma mater as an assistant coach in 2016. The all-time winningest pitcher in program history, Woodard posted a career record of 34-5 over four seasons as a Tar Heel. A native of Charlotte, Woodard was a three-time All-ACC performer and the 2006-2007 recipient of the Patterson Medal, Carolina's highest athletic honor. Following his professional playing career in the San Diego Padres system, Woodard spent the 2011 and 2012 seasons as an assistant at UNC before serving as the pitching coach at UNCW in 2013 and at Virginia Tech from 2014 through 2016. And on the show, we discuss how they develop arms at UNC, what he looks for on the recruiting trail, and we talk about how they use pauses in their delivery to mess with hitters' timing. Ladies and gentlemen, this episode is so good. And here is Robert Woodard. Coach Woodard, welcome to Ahead of the Curve.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you having me on.
Definitely. And, you know, I've been a fan of yours from afar for a long period of time. And so I couldn't tell you how excited I am to get you on the mic and to dig into some player development with you today. But if we have any listeners out there who may not be completely familiar with you, can you just share a little bit about your baseball background and why you decided to get into coaching?
Sure. Yeah. Well, first, I've certainly listened to the podcast a good amount, and you've had some fantastic just baseball minds and coaches on prior to me. So it's an honor to be on here with you. In terms of kind of my background and upbringing, just from Charlotte, North Carolina, probably the mentor that sparked the most enthusiasm for the game for me was a guy named Mike Schilt, who's now the St. Louis Cardinals manager. He was my travel coach for the On-Deck O's in Charlotte, North Carolina for 4 years. He recruited myself and about 20 other 8th and 9th graders to join his startup facility there. And for 4 years, I was really a training ground for us to learn the game, how it's meant to be played and approached and practiced and played and thought about. So that was kind of, for 4 years, I had a major league manager sort of teaching me the game. And it's no surprise to me that he's climbed the ranks to where he is today. He's a special human. So from there, I went and I got to play at my parents' alma mater in Chapel Hill here at UNC, smallest scholarship offer of any school that I was offered from, but it's where I always wanted to play. I get to play for Coach Fox, who's obviously a great mentor of mine, and for 4 years. And then I had two pitching coaches, Roger Williams, who's now the pitching coach at Louisville, and Scott Forbes, who I now coach with, who's my pitching coach for 2 years, two other great mentors of mine in the 4 years I was here at UNC. From there, I was a senior signed 20th rounder with the Padres system, and pretty much pitched my way up to high A before I ran into a slap tear in my labrum at the age of 24, rehabbed it. Timing wise, just wasn't able really to get back at 8 months post-op in spring training 2010, got released, and then had always really wanted to coach, develop players, teach guys the lessons that it helped me be successful up, you know, throughout my career, try to get going and doing that. So at 25, about a month after I got released, I got hired to be the volunteer assistant coach here at UNC. My first game as a coach was actually in the postseason in the NCAA tournament in Norman, Oklahoma. So it'd been Matt Harvey's draft year, 2010. So my first game as a coach was, you know, it was in that type of environment. It was awesome. I was hooked immediately. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately we came up short there in that regional. But that was kind of the beginning of my coaching journey. And I spent 2 full years at Carolina. Got to play in the College World Series in 11 with a really, really great team with Colin Moran and Ken Emanuel, Patrick Johnson, Jacob Stallings, just a bunch of really high caliber player. Actually a coach that one of the guys I coach with now, Jesse Wiersbicki, he was on that team.
Cool.
2012, we lost in a regional, so a really good St. John's team. And then from there, I went and coached in the summer in Cape Cod with Kelly Nicholson, manager of the Orleans Firebirds. Special human, and anybody that's listening who knows him knows what I'm talking about. He's another great mentor of mine, and got hired to join Mark Scaff's coaching staff at UNC Wilmington, coached alongside Randy Hood and Robbie Monday, two of my really good friends in coaching. We were there, it was there in 2013. We had a special team, went to a regional, won the CAA, and just as a young, ambitious coach, was anxious to get back to the ACC, and was very fortunate that Virginia Tech's new head coach, Pat Mason, called me and asked me to be his pitching coach. So I went to Virginia Tech for 3 years, coached there, was really, really just learned some very, very valuable lessons to make me better, and build some special relationships, certainly with players and coaches there. And after 3 years there, after coaching at Virginia Tech in 14, 15, and 16, got the phone call from Coach Fox to come back to Carolina and be the pitching coach here. And so I've been fortunate to be able to come back here in 2017 and 18 as the pitching coach, and coming into 2019 now, in my third year. So in terms of my journey and kind of my path, that's kind of where I've gotten to today.
Definitely. And I love that. And you've basically come full circle since your college years. And I think that's awesome. I guess you're almost a UNC lifer, but let's go ahead and talk about, you know, how you guys are developing your players and, you know, in particularly your pitchers. And I know that you guys are on the forefront of the analytics stuff, which we'll get into here in just a minute, but let's just go ahead and hop right into the fall. And, you know, with you guys having such limited time restrictions, how do you get the most out of the fall? And, you know, depending on the month, I'm sure, but what does a typical week look like for you guys when you're able to get your hands on your players?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's definitely a crash course, with limited time in the fall. I'd say probably one of the most important parts of development occurs in the summer for us, with all of our incoming players come to summer school for 5 weeks, and they take two classes to get ahead academically and get kind of, incorporated into, you know, what it takes to be a successful student. But while they're doing that, they're able to train with our strength staff. So, you know, all these players who are just graduating high school or transferring from a junior college for 5 weeks, they get to stay in a dorm here on campus. You get to come to our stadium. We have a catered breakfast for them from our nutritionist. Then they go to class together. Then they come back to the stadium. They have a catered lunch from our nutritionist and our brand new team's dining facility. In our stadium, and then they change up and they head over and they train with our strength and staff, just whether it's straight strength, speed, conditioning, etc. And then per NCAA rules, we can't do any baseball activities with them. So, you know, they kind of do whatever they need to do on the baseball side after that. They start preparing but that prepares them for the fall. So then once we get into the fall, all of our players come in, they all get assessed by our training staff and our strength staff, just in terms of just their functional movement, strength, mobility, any potential risks or threats that they could come across, just health-wise. And then we can address those things. And, you know, again, just identify any weaknesses they may have that we need to kind of attack, either on the training side or the strength side and their programming and what they're doing. That's kind of early on. And then once we kind of get through that process, we get into skill work for about 2 weeks or so, and guys are built up to throw bullpens, and position guys are are doing, you know, the fundamentals and skill work and learning. We're all, like, all of our players are learning the signs and the system and the routines. We're just really big on here. And kind of that 2-week crash course prepares our guys to jump right into scrimmages, which is where, you know, it's a competitive environment. We'll scrimmage about 3 to 4 days a week. Typically, our pitchers have kind of one compete day and one training day, mm-hmm. essentially a bullpen and then pitching one scrimmages. So that way, over the course of the fall, we can kind of, you know, really kind of train and then put it to the test and then see how it performs and repeat, you know, rinse and repeat for, you know, 6 or 7 weeks. So our fall, our full team practice, 6 days on, 1 day off, runs from usually September 1st to around October 13th or 15th. Like I said, we're scrimmaging 4 days a week. We're practicing 2 to 3 days a week, and we have 1 day off for the guys. So that's kind of a typical fall. And then that, once we get into post fall is where we are now. That's where we start to split up pitchers in terms of guys who threw live. We'll assess kind of where they are in their development, what they need, you know, whether it's more rest and recovery. Maybe it's more, you know, could be velocity training. It could be delivery work. It could be different skill sets. So we really sit down with each pitcher and try to kind of group guys into what they really need for the next 5 or 6 weeks on that end. Then pitchers who were shut down in the fall, they're obviously building back up. So, you know, cause there's a group of those guys, right, that have high volume in the fall and, or in the spring and the summer, who didn't pitch in the fall. So there's, you know, they've been training different than everyone else, obviously. And then, you know, so it's working with them. And then, you know, we're kind of getting into where we are now, which is 6 weeks post fall, our pitchers start to begin the process of rebuilding back up, you know, with both plyos training and throwing to build up to, you know, bullpens post after Christmas to be ready to come back in the fall or in the preseason and compete.
I love it. Now, something that I have a really hard time with, or I did as a pitching coach, was when to shut guys down, or, you know, kind of the categories that you're talking about, which, you know, you're trying to have an individualized plan for each person. So without really drawing any hard lines, are there any things that you say, okay, if a pitcher throws over this amount of innings, or if this pitcher has this workload, we're going to shut him down versus anything? I mean, does that make sense? So what are you looking for when you decide to shut guys down versus when you decide to let them roll throughout the fall?
Yeah, I think one of the things you said was just what you said. Don't really draw any hard lines. I think keeping an open mind and communicating with each pitcher in terms of how he's feeling and, you know, what his, because I think players know themselves really well to a degree. So I think communicating with each pitcher in terms of what his vision for his personal process is. And then obviously, you know, as a coach, communicating, you know, your vision and then kind of meshing the two together, I think is important. Because the player needs to have ownership and belief in what he's doing. I think that's really important. So, I'll sit down with each guy. If I can break it down into its simplest terms, I try to look at kind of the calendar year in the different categories in terms of the spring season, the summer season, and the fall season. And, you know, look at each guy in terms of has he had a heavy, medium to light, or even off workload. And usually for me, if a guy has had a heavy workload in either the spring or the summer, he's usually either going to be limited or off in the fall. You know, if we've got a pitchers who've had a moderate workload in the spring and a moderate workload in the summer, then they're probably going to be limited or full go in the fall. If a pitcher, you know, has had a light spring and a moderate amount in the summer, then he'll probably be full go in the fall. So there's not really, that's really how I try to look at it. Obviously, if a pitcher's had heavy workload in both the spring and the summer, then, you know, he's going to be limited to off in the fall in terms of competition. But that's in terms of simply, like, trying to break it down simply. That's typically how I look at it.
Cool. I really like that a lot. And so, you know, obviously you talked about those guys competing in the fall, like actual scrimmaging, I'm assuming, against live hitters. Mm-hmm. But is there any other ways that you guys compete just from a ranking standpoint or just game stand, like not like actual gameplay, but just side games or anything like that that you guys post in a locker room? So just to get a little bit better understanding of my question. So for hitters right now, we're doing average exit velo, average gains, and peak, and then we're posting those in the locker room so they can kind of see where they're at from week to week. And then whenever I was a pitching coach, we would chart like hit spot percentage, strike percentage, peak, and average velocity and gains and different things like that just to post them so they could see. And they were not only just competing with the other guys trying to see, you know, on their matched up bullpens if they won or not, but they're also competing with themselves to see from week to week what their progressions are. So is there anything that you guys measure like that, that that you get them to compete against each other with?
Sure. You know, probably from a data statistical standpoint, I'd say one of the best things that we probably have incorporated is, and again, this is all the credit goes to Micah Daly Harris. He's our sort of baseball data coordinator, I guess you could call him, / undergrad student. But he's, you know, he's been with us for 3 years and he's assembled a really, really talented group of students that just by their pure passion for, you know, being Carolina students and wanting to help, I've kind of brought them on in a student managerial role. And they've built what's called a data dashboard, where essentially our guys can go on their phones or their computers, and each player has his own individual profile. So after a game, he can go in and he can click on his own post-game report. And essentially, you know, many of the numbers that you talked about are there. So our players are able to see, you know, their performance and their measurables there. They can also see their practice reports just from, you know, Rapsodo or any TrackMan data we're running during practice. They can look there. You know, just in terms of individual, they're constantly being assessed and what their performance quantified. So they can see sort of the trajectory of in which they're going in one way or the other, whether it's, you know, strike percentage of a certain pitch type or in certain count or average velocity, peak velocity, pitch movement. You know, is there movement on certain pitches? Is it increasing in a positive direction? Is it decreasing in a negative direction, or vice versa? You know, they have the capability of seeing this on their data dashboard, you know, the after a game is over. So that's probably, from a statistical standpoint, that's probably where they look the most. But then they also have the ability to look at other guys' profiles, so they can compare, you know, their numbers with other guys on the team's numbers. That's kind of, you know, probably the best way I can say that they get that. From a competition standpoint, one of the things that I think is really prevalent here at Carolina is the environment itself is competitive. I don't think we have to create it. I think that it's a credit to Coach Fox and the coaches that have been here for a long time and the players that have that come before our current players, creating that environment to where they're constantly competing against each other every day. They know that there's a sense of that. And I think that's the driving force that makes everyone better. I've heard multiple guys talk about how they came to Carolina because they wanted to play in the ACC, but what they found that, you know, pitching next to JB Bukauskas or Alex White, mm-hmm, or Matt Harvey, that's what made them better. It wasn't pitching against other teams in the ACC or the teams that you see us play in Omaha that makes us better. It's the daily process of competing against the best of the best that ultimately, you know, makes guys better. So just the environment itself is competitive. Post-fall, I think we do some really neat things. In terms of like our fall World Series, we put miles on the line. That's kind of been a tradition of ours. So like we have a best of three or a best of five series, depending on the year, like most teams do around the country. And the winning team has to run 5 miles and the losing team has to run 10 miles. So, you know, you can imagine there's a big difference between a 5 mile and a 10 mile run. Mm-hmm. But the neat thing is, you know, if that series occurs in the middle of October, for the next 6 or 7 weeks, our players do a ton of competitions each week that can either add or subtract miles to their individual, you know, run, mm-hmm. Which is coming up here in a couple of weeks. So we do, you know, we'll do different team activities. We'll compete in different things, whether it's, you know, one day a week we do a fun activity where miles are on the line. We do community service where miles are on the line, that stuff like that. So you'd be amazed at how much that guys trying to work their miles down will make guys compete. So, and that's kind of been a tradition here. We've done that for a long time. And I've done the 10 mile run 2 or 3 times, and it's a beast because, as you can imagine, Chapel Hill is not a very flat place to run. Mm-hmm. So it's a good challenge. But yeah, I mean, I'd say those are everything our guys are doing just in the weight room and in the bullpen and in scrimmages. You know, it's all being measured and quantified, and guys get that daily feedback via the data dashboard that Mike and his team created to really assess their performance and what they need to get better at and or what they need to continue to doing that's helping them be successful.
For sure. And, you know, I read the Sabermetrics article that you guys were featured in, I think this spring, and it's phenomenal. I'll make sure and link that down in the show notes because it's one of my favorite reads that I've read, and just the story behind how you guys have that team. And it's very, very forward thinking. But I want to dig into a little bit of the culture that you guys have. And it's really interesting because you were a player there, you went away, and then you came back. So talk to us about, you know, the culture that you guys are consistently trying to build. And you've talked about being a competitive culture all the time, but besides like the 10 to 5 mile run and constantly like tacking that down, I guess, what are some other ways that you guys try and, you know, build your leadership, build your team, and then build your culture?
Yeah, you know, we trust our guys. I think that's one of the biggest things in terms of, you know, some, you know, having, you know, gone other places just in general, not necessarily previous places of coach or anything like that, but just, you know, we all see things, been to different places, and we just really trust our players. And we instill a lot of, and what that means is when we instill trust in our players, you know, we give them a lot of leeway in terms of policing themselves and maintaining our team's standards and maintaining that culture that's been built here by, you know, players that have played here for decades before them, you know, because we think that's really important. It certainly starts with us and our coaching staff in terms of our direction and the things that we do and things that we say and how we carry ourselves. But ultimately, trusting our players and recruiting the right players, you know, the guys that are capable of thriving in this culture, is important. I mean, coach has high standards, and we're very upfront with recruits on the front end that come in here and visit here, just in terms of, you know, it takes a person of high character to thrive here. You've got to love competition. You've got to be confident. You know, you've got to have all these things to be successful here. So we try to really identify those things on the front end and recruit as much of those things on the front end to where once they're here, we trust them to, you know, to have those things and then certainly develop them. I guess that's essentially how we do it here.
Oh, definitely. I love that. And if you guys do it on the front end, you get to do the fun stuff on the back end. So I think that's awesome. And yeah, again, that's fantastic. But talk to us about some of the kids that you guys are looking for. So I'm a high school coach. I think the listeners know that, and you know that as well. But I'm constantly trying to get my guys better just to hopefully send them off to colleges like you. But so what are some of the most common problems that you see with the kids coming in? So let's say incoming freshmen, And then, you know, how can we as high school coaches do a better job of helping prevent those problems so you don't have to even mess with them at all?
Yeah, I mean, certainly things like time management are important for most kids coming up to the college level. Mom, dad, their caretakers, whoever it may be, coaches, they take them to and from places. They kind of dictate their entire schedules, you know, when they're coming and going places, and even, you know, what they are and aren't eating. So just players taking on more responsibility for themselves, kind of developing a sense of independence. And then, like I mentioned, time management, the more a player can be developed in kind of those aspects, I think a player will be more prepared to come to certainly Carolina, but you know, anywhere in any baseball program in general throughout the country, I think at the next level, just because it's that important. So I think that's one thing. I think in general too, a lot of guys haven't really learned to fail. Most players, by the time they get to the next level, if high school is a level and then college, whether it's Division I, II, III, NAIA or JUCO, et cetera. I mean, whenever a player gets to another level, they've been recruited to that level, and they've been recruited to that level because they've likely had some level of success. So I think players that look at failure as an opportunity to grow, and they look at challenges that are another opportunity to grow, and are open to trying, you know, new things as opposed to just getting somewhere and being stuck in what they know. I think these are the type of things from a mindset standpoint that guys that I see that are the most successful have the ability to do. So because every player is going to fail or be challenged at some point in their career, if not the high school level, certainly the college level and beyond. And you have to be equipped to handle it. Sure. And embrace it.
Sure. I love that. And it's something that I'm trying to do a better job myself of just failing more often and learning from it, because, you know, my parents did the same thing. I come from a middle-class family and I love them to death, but I think most middle-class families feel like they can do a pretty good job of controlling outcomes. And so I think my parents did a pretty good job of that. But at the same time, I think we see a lot of parents who try and do too much. And hopefully myself someday, because I have a son who's 2 months old now, I can kind of stay out of it and let them grow from that on their own. But talk to us about something that is really interesting that I really, really like that you guys do. And that's messing with timing. And, you know, I've seen you post some videos and for those who are like, what is he talking about? Just think of Marcus Stroman, okay? And I know that he's a rival of y'all's over at Duke, but talk to us about talk to us about how you guys train that, and do you train it, or is it just something that your guys come to you and they're like, hey, I just want to give this a shot, or just walk us through that.
Yeah, no. So essentially, I look at every pitcher has checkpoints in his delivery. Call those checkpoints 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, or A, B, C, D, and E. And, you know, if checkpoint A is is how you dress the rubber, taking the sign, checkpoint B is your rocker step and pivot, and then checkpoint C is your leg lift and balance, and then checkpoint D is hand separation and, you know, dragging towards the plate. E is extension and follow through. Whichever terminology you want to use for those checkpoints is fine. But that's kind of how when I start to teach a pitcher, you know, to disrupt timing, that's kind of where I begin is having each pitcher understand where their checkpoints are on the delivery. Now their normal delivery, their natural delivery that they're comfortable with, that they, you know, they're doing on a daily basis, you know, and then we kind of go from there. In terms of identifying pitchers that we do or don't teach timing with, I try to teach the concepts to each pitcher, mm-hmm. have them understand it. And then honestly, kind of watch and see how they handle it. Some guys will surprise you. Some guys you think that aren't ready for it are actually incredibly ready for it. And then some guys that you think this will come really natural and easy to them, it doesn't. So I try to teach it to each guy. And then as a pitching coach, you know, I know what each guy on a daily basis, you know, looks like and how he moves and that sort of thing. So if I like the direction that it's going, then continue to allow it. If I feel like it's getting in the way of him in any capacity, then certainly as his coach, I would kind of interject. So, but I try to teach the concepts, because even if guys don't physically, you know, alter their delivery or tempo, there's still lessons to be learned in terms of why you would do it, and, you know, why it could help you with, you know, understanding what the hitter is trying to do and what the hitter looks like when he's on time and what the hitter looks like when he's not on time and why that's important. So I try to teach the concept to each pitcher. And like I said, get that, you know, when I do teach it to them, start to break it down to their deliveries and A, B, C, D, and E, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And try to, once we do get into teaching it to the guys, I think it's really important that guys, you know, start the book in chapter one. And a lot of times, pitchers are going to want to, you know, they'll see Stroman or Cueto or whoever it may be. There's a young pitcher with the Rangers, Hans Kraus. You know, it's kind of all over the games now, but guys who are doing things that, you know, what I would call chapter 10 or chapter 11 in the book, in terms of just being really high level, far along in their development type stuff. And that's what they want to immediately jump in and do. And that's what you have to guard against. So chapter one for me is just picking out one aspect of your delivery that you feel really comfortable in. Typically it's a rocker step, and just hold the rocker step for, you know, for longer than you normally would, or skip it, or abbreviate it, whatever it may be. But just pick that one aspect of your delivery and then have the ability to alter it. And for me, when any part of your delivery that you slow up, we call that putting a changeup on a pitch, because, you know, essentially you're trying to get the hitter to be anxious or out front. If we speed up or skip a step of a pitcher's delivery, we call that putting a fastball on a pitch. You could be throwing a slider, but if you go rocker step pivot, and then you go straight into hand separation and leg drive to the plate, then you skip balance, you've essentially forced the hitter to get his foot down early or start the timing, the sequential timing of his swing earlier, as if he's having to gear up for a fastball sooner. So we call that putting a fastball on a slider.
Okay.
Once pitchers really master, you know, one of the basics, they usually try to move on to another one. You know, it could be balancing, just balance at C or three for a little bit longer in the windup with nobody on base. And you've got, you know, that's a little bit more advanced. So now you're getting into like chapters 2 and 3 of the book, you know, and then once you master that and what it feels like to each pitch to both sides of the plate, you can move on to a double leg lift. And that's when you're, you know, like Austin Bergner for us. So he's got a double leg lift to where he'll go lift into C, and then he'll go back down, and then he'll go back up to C again. But that's chapter 8 or 9 of the book, and he's worked really hard to get there. And another aspect of that is too, it's not something that you necessarily need to do from the first pitch of the game on. It's we look at it as a tool. It's a tool that, or a weapon that you can have in your arsenal, that, you know, if you're cruising with your normal delivery throughout the course of the game and you're throwing six shutout, you know, there's no need to go grab that weapon. You don't need it. The weapons you're using are sufficient. But you might get into a situation in the fifth or the sixth, third time through the order, where they might be on your stuff a little bit. Now you can pull this weapon out of your bag, and it can get you through the sixth and into the seventh, or it can get that middle of the order hitter out with runners in scoring position, whatever it may be. So we don't look at it like it's something that you have to do all the time. It's just an aspect of pitching that I want guys to understand. And again, just so that, I mean, the more weapons you can have as a pitcher to get hitters out, I think the more chance you have of surviving and being successful.
Right. And so I'm just thinking to myself that if there are some listeners out there, and, you know, us included, if we've got guys who are good athletes who are 75 to 82, which is kind of your average high school pitcher, do you think this would be really useful for them to try this? And just to, I mean, at the end of the day, we've got to get hitters out. So would this be something that you would suggest for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, if nothing else, you can try it and it fails and, you know, scratch it. You can try it and fail, but now you have a better understanding of reading hitters and recognizing, hey, this guy, you know, this guy's a leg kick guy. I can use it only against those guys or whatever it may be. You just starts to kind of allow pitchers to see the game a little bit at a higher level. So just, it can, at least if nothing else, it can be educational.
Oh, I love it. And, you know, my dad always used to say, you know, hitting is timing and pitching is trying to disrupt that timing. So I think that if this sounds interesting for you, give it a shot and give your kids some ownership for it. And at the end, I think that it would at least, it would make their ears perk up a little bit, which would draw some interest to them because they're like, oh, this is kind of cool. You know, because with hitters, you're like, hey, try a leg kick today. They're like, oh, man. Well, with pitchers, you're like, hey, throw it hard. That's awesome. But let's try and mess with some timing.
Right.
I'm all in. So I love that.
Yeah. 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 It's just another weapon that guys can go to and the battle of getting hitters out.
For sure. Well, let's go ahead and skip to the spring and, you know, we're getting there faster than I can even imagine, but let's take a Friday starter or just any day of the week starter for you. And if you don't mind, just kind of run through what your, you know, recovery program looks like. I know that a lot of the questions that we have for the podcast are, what do we do with pitchers in between starts? And obviously that depends on, you know, their workload and how they feel and all of these different things. But if you had to, you know, give us an outline of a program that we could take tomorrow and use for our staff, do you mind walking us through a little bit of that?
Sure. You're talking about more like just like a typical college starting pitcher routine.
Right.
Pre, post throw, that type of thing.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I mean, we're huge on routines. So for me, I can only speak on our pitchers here at Carolina. We try to individualize each guy's program as much as we can to his needs. So we have pitchers, we have starting pitchers. We'll just talk about starters for right now. And we have starters that some of them will prefer to bullpen on day four. Some of them prefer to bullpen on day five. Some of them prefer to throw a short pin on day three and day five. So for me, it's just really establishing as early as possible is what is each pitcher's best individual routine. Mm-hmm. And then once we have kind of like that bullpen day locked down, everything goes from there because that'll kind of dictate what we're doing from a drive line, plyo or over weighted ball protocol, a weekly throwing routine, our lift routine, our conditioning routine, emphasis that we put on nutrition, arm care recovery, flexibility, mobility, core work, mental preparation, skill work, and those types of things. I mean, I run through those fast, but that's what we look at as our pitcher's process. So, and every day looks a little bit different. So for example, like a pitcher, for us, a pitcher's compete day, he has a game day routine of, you know, what time he gets to the yard, what music he listens to, what he eats, when he starts to go to the weight room, or wherever it may be to begin his activation routine, what time he walks out of the dugout down to the left field, you know, down to the bullpen, to begin his routine there. He goes into his pregame throwing session, which will be the same routine every single time that he goes to make a start, pretty much down to the throw and the distance. Again, not necessarily scripted, but it is ironed out and they each know it. To what time they get into the bullpen, to their sequences in the bullpen of, you know, progressions, whether it's, you know, establishing the fastball, their primary off-speed pitch, and then their secondary off-speed pitches and certain sides of the plate, might finish with simulating hitters, counts, et cetera. And then what time they walk into, sit down in the dugout, get a drink of water, gather their thoughts, concentrate on their breathing, and then go to take the mound. So I tried to run through that really fast, but those are the type of things that we really value in terms of like a pregame routine for a starting pitcher.
Cool.
Yeah. We'll compete throughout the course of the day. And then as soon as their outing is over, we'll go in and we start preparing for our next outing. That's how we look. As soon as our pitcher's outing's done, the clock starts on preparing for that next start or that next appearance, to an opportunity to help our team win. So typically our guys go into the weight room, and yeah, we go through a lot of driveline protocols in terms of their recovery methods and arm care, certain level of conditioning.
Mm-hmm. You guys run?
And then, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So typically we go through 10-minute continuous. So some guys prefer the treadmill, some guys prefer the bike, but yeah, like we'll go through mostly, but it's a ton of, you know, upward tosses with the plyos, rebounders, band pull aparts, no monies, mm-hmm. Those types of things, shoulder blade, body tube, Jaeger band, kind of back of the shoulder stuff, the cross ball rollout for soft tissue, got a Mark Pro. If we have access to that, we can use that. Mm-hmm. So just various things that we feel kind of jumpstart the recovery process. We have hydrotherapy here at our stadium, cold hot tubs that guys can jump into as well. But like I said, so everything kind of for the rest of the week, the next in college 6 days gears towards around which days or day they're going to bullpen, mm-hmm. and that affects their lifting schedule. So for typically, just to run through it, our starting pitcher's heavy lower emphasis lift is going to be the day after he starts, and then the day of his bullpen, we'll have another leg circuit day, and then the day after his bullpen, we'll have a total body day. You know, we typically in season limit the amount of upper body workload that we put on our pitchers in the weight room. Doesn't mean, you know, obviously we have movements and lifts for that, but you know, we're not doing too much on the strength side with our upper extremities in season outside of our plyo training, our driveline, our arm care routines, those types of things, you know, grip work, different things for that. So that's kind of a lift schedule. And then, yeah, just our conditioning schedule. We'll have a work capacity day on day two and day three. And then we'll have a speed power choice, which again, this is just for us. It'll be posted for our guys. We have work capacity days, and we have speed days, and we have agility days. And again, our guys just have different options for those that they kind of incorporate into their week. We're big on nutrition. So the day after our guys compete, we emphasize getting large meals and proteins, protein into their system, emphasize getting 3 meals, 2 snacks each day. Mm-hmm. The day of a bullpen, our guys, you know, we're trying to get amino acids and omega-3s for recovery. Days before, you know, before pens and before games, we're emphasizing sleep and hydration. So, you know, again, this is just aspects of our process that we look at, you know, here at Carolina.
So something that, you know, I thought I didn't do a very good job of early on in my career, and that's I probably ran pitchers too much, just because, you know, that's it's kind of the culture of you get done running and and we didn't run poles or, you know, or miles and miles at a time, but we would do just sprint work and then we'd go to the weight room. And I just felt like, you know, it was by the end of the season, our guys were worn down a little bit from doing both. But
sure.
What's your best advice? And especially being a guy that did it at a high level, so you're right there with those guys. But should we, every day, should we do some sort of conditioning, or should we scale it back? Because, I mean, obviously pitching's really hard on your body as it is, but I want to know, what do you think that you guys have found to be kind of that happy medium?
Sure. Yeah, for us, I think without going into too much detail, I think it's important to look at your season as split it up into various phases. So for us, like, we play a 15-week regular season, split that up into if phase one is 5 weeks, phase two is the middle 5 weeks, and then phase three is the last 5 weeks. We typically taper down. So as you can imagine, our winter and preseason training is pretty intense because we're not competing yet. So we're trying to get stronger and more mobile and faster, you know, develop athleticism as much as possible in that phase. And then once you get into that first phase, you begin kind of tapering things down and then once you get the second phase, you taper down again, and then you get to the third phase, the back 5 weeks of the season, you taper down again. Just because, like you said, over the course of the season, there's going to be natural wear and tear, and it can be harder for guys to recover. Mm-hmm. So I think you certainly need to be mindful of that. And for us, that's how we try to really break it down, is we phase every aspect of the year. Our strength and conditioning staff, Coach Greg Gatz, is our coordinator, and he does a phenomenal job in terms of sort of regulating that. But that's how we at Carolina try to look at it, is like you said, we try to taper down as the season goes and breaking our season into phases.
Well, awesome. And, you know, I asked this question because it's something that I've struggled with as well. And so how do we develop command, and how do we develop even just control first and then command? And are there any practical ways that you guys do that rather than just playing catch with some intent?
It's a great question. You recruit command. That's how you develop it. No, I'm just kidding.
Kind of.
But no, I mean, it's sort of. It's a, like you said, I mean, it's a daily mindset. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a daily mindset. I mean, our pitchers, when they throw, that you know, every single throwing session our guys have, whether it's targets to the glove, or it's checkpoints on the body, our guys are constantly throwing, with the mindset that they're attempting to narrow their focus, right? Like, don't look at the center of the mitt. You look at the lace hanging off the bottom of the catcher's mitt. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about in terms of narrowing the focus. Mm-hmm. So our guys throw with that mindset on a daily basis, have begun to implement, to a degree with some of our pitchers, some over and under load training, with weighted baseballs, kind of can really help enhance the feel of the release point and challenge, you know, the repeatability of that with integrating 4, 5, and 6 ounce throwing ball, baseballs into that training. Again, a lot of those protocols stem from what the guys at Driveline are doing in Seattle.
Sure.
So we've used those to a degree with some guys, and had some good responses and feedback and success so far. So that's something that we've implemented as well. But yeah, and then just initially here, without going too long, those are probably things that I think is where a good place to start.
I love it. And you know, it's something that we talk about in Little League, and it's something that we're constantly harping on in high school, college, and I'm sure pro ball as well. And you know, another aspect of, I was a catcher growing up, so I didn't pitch a whole lot, and so I've always been curious of what people say on a mound visit, or you know, guys like yourself, what do you guys say on a mound visit? And so can you, it probably depends on the person, but go into that. Sure. A little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It just really depends on the situation. It can depend on the pitcher. I'd say, I try to never take a mound visit unless I know with certainty I have one nugget or certain thing that, you know, I know that I can bring to the pitcher or to the players on the field, you know, so that's important. But yeah, I mean, it can be different things. You can be, reminding a guy that there might be a pinch hitter that's coming up, and you might need to run through a short scouting report on the hitter. It could be, just a reminder of a bunt defense or a pickoff play. It could be some form of a positive affirmation for a guy that you can tell that just really needs to get to a more positive place, help him visualize a positive outcome. It could be a lot of different things, really. Usually it's some form of short-term adjustment or focal point or, you know, something positive for the pitcher to take away, and help him get out of that situation. Usually it's not mechanical. Unless it's a pitcher that has shown the ability to, you know, something that you've worked on with a pitcher.
Sure.
There might be an external cue that he's really has shown the ability to respond well to. That's probably as much in the mechanics as I'll get in a mound visit, is an external cue. But it's typically all of those things, you know, or one of those things. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for sharing. And again, I'm always curious to see, because you don't know what other coaches are saying up on a mound because you can't hear them. So I love that. And I think that that's fantastic. But let's go into your personal growth a little bit. And I'm sure it's you've grown a lot since you've played. But talk to us about, and I say that because I know I have. I thought I knew the game, and then I got done and got into coaching, and I realized that I didn't even scratch the surface of what I needed to know. But talk to us about some changes that you guys were making from last year to this year. And again, you're a lifelong learner, and I'm sure that we could spend an entire podcast on this. But what are some things that you guys did last year that you were like, we can do it a little bit better, and now that you're doing this year?
Yeah, so we're in the process of upgrading the video system in our, in our bullpen. We're looking to add some high speed cameras with some slow mo software and an outdoor TV, so that our guys can get replay on their pitches. That's something we're in the works of doing now. Yeah, just constantly trying to refine guys training a little bit smarter. So we've broken guys up into more specialized groups in terms of trying to, get them to accomplish something more specific. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say, much more than that. I wouldn't say there's too much ground. There's nothing really groundbreaking or revolutionary really to share.
I gotcha. Well, what about your own personal learning? Is there anything that you've learned lately that's gotten you really excited, that you're like, man, this in the pitching delivery, or this on recovery, or this or that, that you're like, man, I need to dig into this more. And it's again, like I said earlier, it's gotten you really excited.
Yeah. And I mean, just everything with the high speed cameras, being able to see the ball come off the pitcher's fingers and starting to understand, what the cause and the effect of that process, I guess. So in terms of, trying to gain a better understanding of when, for example, a pitcher throws a good changeup and you see the ball come off of, his middle and ring finger, would he actually benefit more of it only coming off of his middle finger? Trying to really get a better understanding of, what that video is showing and what is the story it's telling and how that can affect our players. That's probably the aspect that I'm probably most excited about trying, sinking my teeth into right now, and really pitch planning for guys, based on their arsenals and what Micah and his team are telling me in terms of their pitch value, based on what their pitches are grading out as velocity and movement wise, their ability to tunnel their pitches, and just try to come up with as good of a pitch plan for each pitcher as possible, especially this winter going into the preseason. That's something that I'm excited about, those types of things.
Very cool. And I've got two more questions for you before we let you go. And again, I'm so thankful that I've gotten to have you on the mic, and you've given us a ton of good information, but I want to know what's something that you guys do in practice, whether it be a competition or just some fun game, or just anything that you guys do that your players love and they just get really excited whenever you guys do it.
again, it's probably nothing that's too revolutionary on other teams around the country. It's just, as a coaching staff, we try to bring the same effort and energy and attitude to the yard with us every day. So I just think there's a certain level of consistency. The guys know what to expect when they get to the yard. We enjoy being around each other. We do have, I guess one thing I will say is we're, as a pitching staff here, we're kind of big into music. So we have a Bose speaker that I'll bring to the bullpen most days. There's days where, we need to throttle that down and don't need it, but most days we actually have our pitchers will pick a Pandora station, which it can get really interesting. Clean music, obviously, but we have music going in the bullpen pretty much all the time, whether it's guys going through their pre-throw activation routine, guys are going through some form of velocity training with the plyos in the bullpen. We'll have it to a certain degree during throwing sessions. We'll pin with music during certain guys' bullpens. just kind of, again, there's research in terms of music and helping pitchers get into a flow state, which is a whole nother conversation. So I grew up, my brother's a musician. My parents love music. Music was a big part of my training and preparation as a player. So, I think our guys look forward to, you know, having some element of music going, you know, in the bullpen when they're there. Plus it's individualized to them too. Like I can tell sometimes what kind of mood they're in based on what station you go with. So it makes every day a little bit different, which is cool.
Definitely. I love that answer. Now, again, before you go, can you kind of empty out your pockets to any resources or books or anything that's really shaped your coaching career and share with us?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, really for me, I think Ahead of the Curve by Brian Kenny, it's a phenomenal book. It covers a wide range of the game and where it's going and things that, you know, you should be kind of looking at. Travis Sawchik, Big Data Baseball, sort of recaps the Pittsburgh Pirates and how they revamped their player development and in-game approach to make it back to the playoffs, some things that they did. Yeah, I'm in the process of a lengthy read, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a, it's a great read so far. So I'm a big audiobook guy. I think if coaches out there can, you know, pick up Amazon Audible and download various books, and instead of going music or phone calls on the ride, you can go more that route. Since I started doing that a couple years back, I felt like that my growth as a coach has really developed.
I love it. And so I'm a huge audiobook fan. I listen to Audible myself. And so, Robert, again, thank you so much for being with us today. And if any of our listeners would like to reach out, is there a way that they can get in touch with you and ask you some questions about today's show?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my Twitter handle is @rwoodard20. And you can shoot me a DM. And then my email address is rwoodard@unc.edu. Feel free to shoot me an email as well. Obviously for the high school players out there and high school parents out there, there's certain rules in terms of guys I can and can't respond to. So if you're a 2021, 22, 23 grad, that's going to be pretty limited. But outside of that, those are the two ways for sure to get up with me.
I love it. Well, I'm just going to open up the mic for you. And is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners before you go?
I mean, one thing I do want to finish with is the more time I spend with our staff and our players and Brett and Micah, is the more I realize that I have so much more to learn, and it's exciting. And I'm hopeful that I never get to a place where that's not the case. Because you really can never figure it all out.
Thank you for listening to Ahead of the Curve. Before you go, I'd love to be able to get in touch with you, and we have several different ways of doing so. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram @AOTC_podcast. You can join the AOTC Coaches Facebook group. And if you want to be a part of the mini clinic emails, both of those links are listed below. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or review to help others find and stay ahead of the curve.